From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Cadillac's move to the Big Apple.
I think what it's hoping to fix is its understanding of the customers that they want, not the customers that they have.
Newly elected representatives hit Capitol Hill.
You've got to look for housing. You've got to get office space. You need to find a new staff. You need to make new friends. There's a freshman orientation.
Could the state capitol lawn get a nativity scene?
The person who puts it up would actually have to take it down every evening and then set it up again every morning.
And Tony Luca from Oakland County to The Voice and beyond.
This record was kind of a change for me. You know, I kind of stepped out of my singer-songwriter lyrical approach and got a little more creative.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. It's freshman orientation for our representatives-elect. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the do's and don'ts for Michigan's rookie lawmakers as they get ready to head to D.C. But first, someone has asked to set up a Christmas nativity scene on the lawn of the state capitol. That request tees up the inevitable, seemingly annual tussle of separation of church and state and free speech. MLive Lansing reporter Jonathan Osting is with us now. Do we know who's made this request, Jonathan?
It's not entirely clear at this point, actually. The Michigan State Capitol Commission is reviewing the request. And they're not going to make the name of the person public until after they've decided on the issue and whether they're going to move forward with it. Word is it's somebody from out of state, but that hasn't been confirmed just yet.
So the Michigan State Capitol Commission, newly formed, has the first big item on its plate. What are they doing about this request?
Yeah, so this commission was just formed in the last year, and they actually don't have their own process set up for seeking legal advice. So that was one of their first orders of business. They have contracted with the Attorney General's office for legal advice, due in part to this nativity request. Requests of this kind have led to legal challenges in some Michigan cities and other parts of the country, and they basically wanted to make sure they have their bases covered in case that happens. So they've got an attorney ready to review the case before they make a decision.
And are we expecting to see a decision in time for, if the answer is yes, something to be set up in the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, the request was for the month of December, as I understand it. So they are trying to move quickly on it. The commission seems to be leaning towards approving it. It seems like they are pretty clear that that it should be allowed, but they just want to make sure, like I said, in case of a lawsuit. There's a couple of issues here. One is that the Capitol grounds, there are rules that doesn't allow protesters or other groups of any kind to set up displays overnight. So if this nativity is approved, the person who puts it up would actually have to take it down every evening and then set it up again every morning. So they're running that by the attorneys to make sure those rules are, in fact, good practice and that they're not setting themselves up for a problem there.
Interesting. Now, you poked around, Jonathan, into what happened when Florida approved a nativity scene for its state capitol. What kind of requests came in after they said yes to the Christians?
Yeah, sure. So one issue that Michigan has to deal with is if they approve this nativity scene, they will likely have to approve any other similar requests that come their way for the holiday season. So in Florida, their version of the Capitol Commission approved a nativity, and it sort of opened the floodgates for requests from atheist groups, from a religion or a fake religion, I guess, called the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, which seeks to sort of poke fun at some of the tenets of Christianity and other religions. So, yeah, in Florida, they had a Festivus poll. If you've ever seen the show Seinfeld, that was, again, sort of a fake holiday tradition created on that show. And this one in Florida was adorned with PBR beer cans. The spaghetti monster people that I mentioned, who call themselves Pastafarians, they set up a display of noodles and meatballs on a chair in the Capitol. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation took a little bit more sober route, and they just set up a banner highlighting the birth of the Bill of Rights rather than the birth of Jesus Christ.
And you did note in your story for MLive, Jonathan, that Florida did draw the line with what they called a grossly offensive request from a group calling itself the Satanic Temple.
Yeah, that's right. They did. As far as I know, that was the only request that they did turn down. They said it just, you know, crossed the line of decency, which, you know, did create some controversy there. I think the ACLU locally got involved saying that, you know, the Capitol couldn't pick and choose. I'm not sure whatever happened with that case, but the Satanic Church display was, in fact, prohibited.
Has there been, can you remember when there's been a request for a nativity scene at the state capitol?
I haven't. ACLU representative I talked to here in Michigan said she doesn't remember in the past, you know, 12 years that she's been in town. But longtime capitol correspondent Tim Skubick and Bill Ballinger, I was talking to yesterday, both said they remembered, you know, years ago that there used to be sort of a standing nativity scene. But that was long before these new rules that do prohibit overnight displays. So, you know, if somebody does decide to do this again this year, it would likely be a lot more work.
Jonathan Osteen, Capitol reporter for MLive. As always, thanks so much, Jonathan.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
What will it take to make GM's jewel, Cadillac, a true member of the world's luxury car club? Detroit News business columnist Daniel House has been thinking about what's ahead as Cadillac moves its headquarters and 100 employees to New York City. Daniel, what's this move to SoHo supposed to be doing for Cadillac?
I think what it's hoping to fix is its understanding of the customers that they want. Not the customers that they have necessarily, the customers that they want. They have a real problem on the coasts from Boston down through New York into Washington, a real redoubt of money and influence in the country, and the same thing on the West Coast. So their feeling is if we go to New York and if we kind of immerse ourselves and our people in those in that culture and in those people, we might have a better understanding of how to market the products to those customers. The irony is, of course, they'll still be built here in the Midwest, primarily in Michigan, and developed here by engineers and product developers who live and work in Michigan.
It sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that GM is kind of saying these Detroit roots aren't cool enough for the rich buyers who buy, I love, as you put it, the Teutonic triumvirate of BMW, Mercedes, or Audi. Very aptly put.
Yeah, a couple of things here. I think that's right. The problem here is we've got an American brand that has had a lot of difficulty over the years, kind of lost its way in the decade of the early 2000s and the late 90s, got back on track, I think, in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years with some very solid product that in a lot of cases is probably as good as what's coming out from the Germans. The problem is they don't have a product line that's as broad as those players, and I don't think they're regarded as being credible and being in the same league. And the other thing I would say is that the luxury club is a German club. It was founded by the Germans. The rules were drafted by the Germans, and the rules are enforced by the Germans. And they pretty much decide, and their buyers, whether or not you can be a member of that club. I would raise the question as to whether they will ever be able to break through and be regarded in the same breath as Mercedes, Audi, and BMW. That's not to say they don't have the technical capability. I think clearly General Motors has demonstrated that it does have enormous technical capability. They've got some products that are world-class, unparalleled. I mean, the Corvette and its permutations is in a class in a lot of ways by itself. Full-size pickups are another example. They have the capability. The question is whether they're going to be able to package it and break through to the kind of customer that they want to break through to. I think the other thought that they have is, and Mary Barra, the CEO, said this to us in a recent interview, is, you know, you drive around Metro Detroit, for example, and you see a lot of Cadillacs. You say, well, Cadillacs are not a problem. There's a lot of Cadillacs. Well, yeah, those are people that are buying vehicles based on employee discounts and leasing programs and things like that. You don't see that if you're driving around Summit, New Jersey, or Boston, or suburban Washington, necessarily.
What do you think the new Cadillac global brand chief, Yohan Dhanisian, what do you see him bringing to the table in this push?
Well, he brings a lot of credibility. One of the things that's happened in the late Dan Akerson tenure and now in Mary Barr's tenure is they've gone out and hired people for key critical positions, in many cases outside the United States, but also in the Danishin case for a global job, that have the credibility of the German auto industry. He spent a lot of years at Audi. He was the head of Audi USA when it actually moved its headquarters from Auburn Hills to suburban Washington, D.C. He also was the global head of the Infiniti brand based in Hong Kong for the last several years. I think a lot of people think he's got real credibility. He knows what he's doing. He understands the industry. He understands what makes premium and luxury different from other manufacturers and how you need to approach those brands and how you need to market those brands. So no one is saying this guy's not up to it. In fact, in my column today, I talk about this is a 10-year process, at least. One of the things that General Motors with Cadillac and Ford, to some extent with Lincoln, have not been very successfully is keep people in the same jobs and have a long kind of process of seeing this through and seeing the strategy through as opposed to changing. A brand can't necessarily withstand a lot of corporate strategic rethinks and changes at the corporate level. You've got to stick with it, and that's one of the lessons of the Germans is that they've stuck with an iteration and iterated their product line and expanded it, but always improving it. And I think one of the things that we've seen with Cadillac and with Lincoln to some extent has been an inability of these companies to have that kind of focus. In part, I think it's because they're grounded more in the volume car business. That's where they grew up. That's where General Motors grew up, selling Chevrolets and other brands to all people in purses, as Albert Sloan used to say. And so did Ford. And it's really not part of their DNA, whereas you look at Mercedes, it's been a high-end premium manufacturer pretty much since its inception. Same thing for BMW, although more sporty, but it's clearly been part of their DNA.
An interesting look at the long rebuild ahead for Cadillac. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanksgiving brings such an emphasis on food, and that can pose challenges to the 1.7 million people in Michigan who are food insecure, particularly if they're trying to find a fresh, healthy meal. Ken Estelle is the CEO of Feeding America West Michigan. He's a board member also at the Food Bank Council of Michigan. Ken, very good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Cindy.
It seems this is the time of the year, Ken, we see stepped-up food drives at churches and schools and businesses and organizations. And, of course, I know this from our own church. When you're bringing in donations to a food drive, you're asked to bring non-perishable, non-breakable items. Makes total sense. But that means canned and boxed processed food. Would you say this makes up the majority of what's donated to food banks?
Yeah, I mean, typically food banks have always dealt with non-perishable product because it's what's able to be stored fairly easily. And so that has been kind of a tradition. But more and more, we're really striving to provide more fresh product to those who are needing help.
I've got to wonder about the thoughts that you have about the nutritional value of, you know, all those boxes of mac and cheese dinner or the cans of baked beans versus getting fresh fruits and vegetables out to people.
Yeah, and across the food banks in Michigan, we're really working hard and doing quite well in getting more fresh produce than ever before. So we see that trend really changing, and we see more opportunities for all of our food banks in Michigan to provide more fresh produce to our families.
Where do the donations of the fresh food come from?
Well, most of them come through our local farmers. Michigan is really blessed with a huge diversity of crops. In fact, we're second only to California in the number of crops and the diversity that we have for different fruits and vegetables. So most of them come directly from Michigan farmers, and we have a host of just really generous farmers who are caring about people who don't always have enough to eat and are very generous in terms of their ability to donate and work with the various food banks around the state.
How does it get from that donating farmer onto the tables of people who need it, knowing you've got to do it quickly before that the fruits and vegetables spoil?
Yeah, a lot of the farmers, it'll come a couple of different ways. Most, the highest volume is farmers that will actually harvest the crop on our behalf. And generally what they do is their prime crop will go to market, and that's where they obviously make their money, and we like to have financially healthy farmers. But there's always the seconds and thirds, and they may not be exactly the right size or maybe the right color to go to market, but they're perfectly good product. And so generally the farmers will harvest those for us, or we will send volunteers out to the farmers directly and harvest these crops ourselves. And basically they come into the food banks, and most of our food banks in Michigan are now doing what we're calling mobile pantry deliveries, where we basically take products like fruits and vegetables, and we put dairy and some other things on there. We'll take those trucks directly into a community, and then in cooperation with a local church or community center, we'll actually set up tables right around the truck, and we'll distribute that food immediately to families in need. And so it's really a good way of getting that very perishable product into the hands of people who need it very quickly. And we've been doing more and more of that type of distribution across the state. So this program generates probably close to nine to 10 million pounds of produce a year. I think that we still have quite a ways to go to be able to make sure that every family who needs help has available produce, and that's really what we're trying to do, is just to try to make that available to families and also help them know what to do with it when they get it. So there's also programs that, like Cooking Matters and other programs, where we actually have some instructional activities that help families understand, well, what do I do with this particular vegetable if I haven't seen one like it before? And so we're getting better at helping people use what we have available as well.
I'm talking with Ken Estelle, who's the CEO of Feeding America West Michigan and also a board member at the Food Bank Council of Michigan. Ken, has demand on food banks in Michigan leveled off at all as we move out of the Great Recession?
Well, actually, which would be kind of counterintuitive, the demand has actually increased.
Why?
And, yeah, we've seen just in our food bank here in West Michigan, where we serve 40 counties, about half of the state by this food bank, we've had our highest distribution year in 2013 in our 33-year history. And 2014 is right now tracking about 5% above that. And so you ask why, and when we talk to folks, more and more of the people that are finding it hard to consistently have food on the table are people that may have jobs. And what we're finding is the income has not really changed much in the last few years, but the costs have. So we're actually seeing a greater gap between what people are earning and what things cost, food being one of them. And so that as that gap grows, we actually have, I'd say, almost 50% of the people that come to a food pantry or a mobile food truck are employed or have a part-time job or have multiple part-time jobs, but simply don't have enough income to consistently provide for their family.
And I have to imagine there are many people walking in for help who never, ever thought the day would come when they would have to do that.
Yeah, we see families and a lot of folks that don't even know where to start in some cases, because they never really had to worry about it. And so, you know, obviously we're trying to help those folks, and there's some pride involved, and people don't like to admit that they need help. And we really are focused on dignity and being able to be there to serve those folks and have them feel really comfortable when they come for assistance.
Ken, I have to imagine that those of you who work hard all year round to keep food pantries stocked look at the annual holiday food drives, and I know you're grateful, but at the same time, I've got to imagine you wish some of that might happen, let's say, in the middle of March and not just in November and December.
Oh, great point. Yeah, as you know, I do like to eat other times than the holidays, as most people. So the need for food is year-long. It's not. I mean, I think we think about it at the holidays because we think of those who don't always have enough or don't have as much as we might have. And so we think about how we can help. And the holidays are a great time to kind of bring that to the forefront. But your message, your point is very clear. We really need to have the food all year long, and the need is constant throughout the year.
And what would you say concerned individuals or groups or communities, what can they best do to help Michigan food banks, especially in this quest for fresh and nutritious food?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that really we benefit from. One, all of our food banks really depend on volunteers. So if anyone's able to give of their time, that is so valuable. And every food bank in the state really depends on volunteers to help sort the food. A lot of times the produce we get needs to be sorted or repackaged, and so we need volunteers to help do that. In some cases, we'll need volunteers to help harvest produce from farmers that will maybe open up their orchards or their fields to donate product. So volunteering is a really good way, a hands-on way that you can get involved and get your family involved or your church or community organization involved. So that's probably a big thing that we look for. And additionally, all of our food banks rely a lot on donations and private funding. We're all nonprofit organizations, and a lot of the costs that we have in terms of transporting this food are constant. So looking at how you can leverage a donation to your local food bank or food pantry is another way that, that people can help. As an example, $1 would provide up to 4 meals for a family in need by working through the food bank. So that's a great way of stretching your dollar in terms of providing food. And there was a third way I would actually also suggest, and that is we ask people to be aware and just to understand that the need in our community and in our state is still real, and that there are still many, many families that struggle every day or at least every week with how they're going to put food on their table or how they're going to feed their family consistently. So the need is still there, and we just like folks to be able to be aware of that need and don't forget about it, even as we might hear positive signs in the economy.
Ken, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ken Estelle is the CEO of Feeding America West Michigan and a board member at the Food Bank Council of Michigan. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tony Luca caught the nation's attention when he was a finalist on the second season of NBC's The Voice.
And if you take me by the hand with the whole world watching, never gonna let you go, cause only you know.
Was in 2012. Tony Luca was born in Pontiac, grew up in Waterford. His showbiz career got a very early start as he was cast in the early 1990s version of the Mickey Mouse Club, where his fellow Musketeers included Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, and Justin Timberlake. Well, this Sunday night, he's back in Michigan for a show in Detroit. Tony Luca, good to have you with us on Stateside.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, national TV, you have toured with Maroon 5 and Kelly Clarkson and Sarah Bareilles and more. Now you're about to release your 8th studio album. Did you have this in your dreams growing up in Waterford?
To be honest, yeah, I did. I grew up playing with a cousin of mine who actually grew up a bit more closer to Milford and Highland. We're both products of a huge music-making family. You know, my grandfather was a pretty well-known pianist back in sort of the radio days of the Auntie Dee show. And so, yeah, everyone in our family kind of got a little bit of the bug. But my cousin and I, yeah, we took to it early. You know, I think we were like 8 or 9 when we started strumming and learning songs. And I think we were getting paid by the time we were 12. So it was always, it seemed pretty destined for sure.
What is it like? We watch The Voice. We watch these competitions, American Idols as well. The idea of stepping out there and putting it all out there, and it's basically like the, you know, the Colosseum in ancient Rome, thumbs up, thumbs down. Is there a sense of nervousness, or is it just a sense of, no, I belong here?
Well, I'll be completely honest and say that I have never been, nor will I probably ever be, as nervous again as I was for that blind audition. I don't know what it was. I mean, you know, there's just maybe it's just because it's one thing to, you know, have grown up playing in the suburbs of Detroit at bars and clubs and things and trying to, you know, draw people's attention away from a Red Wings game or something. know? And you're trying to, like, get them to tune into what you're doing and listen to what you're singing about. But, you know, when the sole purpose is to get someone to turn around their chair and, you know, like, that it really was like an unnatural setting. And I don't know why it shocked me how nervous I got for that silly audition. But as soon as the chairs started turning around, I mean, you can you could see it in my face. Like I that was definitely one of those moments where I felt completely justified. I felt like all of the encouragement and the support and the prayers and all the goodwill that had been shown to me over the course of my career was just coming at me in a tidal wave of contentment. It was a really cool moment.
I woke up cold in a raging fire, froze my soul and the flames got higher. And so it goes, hey, and everybody knows it. This heavy load, I'll be like, I got this, yeah, I got this. If you're down, let me hear you say, ho, hold on tight, don't you ever let me go. Keep your faith in the hand that you hold. I hear you say, holler, holler. Let the truth come set you free. Only you got the life that you need. Raise your hands if you want to believe. I hear you say, holler, holler.
Tony, what do you think your Michigan identity means to you as an artist and as a performer?
It's almost synonymous with family, really, because truth of it is I left Detroit, or I left Michigan rather early. I was 15 when I started coming and going, you know, where I would go shoot down in Florida for the Mickey Mouse Club. I'd come back for a couple months each winter to go back to my high school and check in and whatnot. But I do feel like there is a grit and a tenacity that comes from the school of music that I grew up in, that was really just my family. You know, there was a blue collar element to it, but a very modest but no nonsense approach to it. You know, so when I think of being from Michigan, I think of the values that were instilled in me. You know, the salt of the earth kind of element of coming from good stock, and I certainly did. You know, my folks still live in Oakland County. They're out there in Waterford, and they're still married after 42 years now. and you know, that's a rare thing. The older I get, the more I realize how exceptional that is. And I just, you know, yeah, again, my mom was the 10th of 12 kids, and so there was just, I've got a lot of family, and it's always good to know that you've got that in your corner, and Michigan is kind of the hotbed for that.
You know, Tony, I know my question that I'm going to hit you with next is kind of like asking a parent to pick a favorite child, but here goes anyway. Is there a track off of your upcoming new album you think best sums up who you are as an artist?
Man, that's a good question. I do, I guess. This record was kind of a change for me. You know, I kind of stepped out of my singer-songwriter lyrical approach and got a little more creative, a little more imaginative. There's a song on the record that is kind of a departure from the record. A lot of the record's pretty heavy and early 80s, late 70s rock. But there's a song on there that's called Paint a Picture, and it almost didn't make the record because it's, like I said, it's a little different than the rest of the record, but my kids were really fun in making the record, and they, you know, they would be straight with me, and when I told them that the song might not make the record, my son got really upset about it. And I think his words were, your record's going to stink. I was like, oh, thanks, man. You know, I was like, well, he could be onto something. Let's double check this. So we wound up putting it on the record anyway. But, you know, there's a line in the song. Basically, the refrain is that my love ain't going nowhere. You know, like, I'm here. I'm dedicated to this. And this, you know, sort of specifically in the song, it's my family. It's my wife. It's my kids. I'm here for the long haul. But I suppose you could have that pertain to my dedication to my craft and my career as well.
Tony Luca, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Tony Luca will be performing this Sunday at the Magic Stick on Woodward, right there in Detroit's Midtown area. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Election Day 2014 is in the history books. And now for the five new members of Michigan's congressional delegation, it's time to learn exactly what happens next. It's freshman orientation time for our representatives-elect. Cheryl Gay Stolberg explored what all of this is like in a recent piece for the New York Times. Cheryl, what's happening for these Capitol Hill newbies kind of reminds me of going with my daughter to her freshman orientation at Michigan State.
Well, you know, going to Congress is a lot like going to college, especially for people who haven't had experience in Washington before. So you've got to look for housing. You've got to get office space. There's a lottery for that on Capitol Hill. You need to find a new staff. You need to make new friends. There's a freshman orientation. Yeah, it is a lot like going to college.
Even the class picture.
A class picture, exactly.
It has to be jarring for these Capitol Hill newbies to suddenly switch gears from all the long months of fundraising and campaigning and then suddenly trying to figure out where you're going to live and hoping you get a decent office and committee assignment.
You know, it really is. I talked to one new lawmaker coming in from Arizona. He arrived in Washington. He lives in Phoenix. He started looking around for an apartment, discovered very quickly that it costs $1,900 a month to rent a 400-foot studio on Capitol Hill, and thought, oh, my goodness, you know, what am I going to do? Some of them are trying to find roommates. They want to hook up with other members of Congress, new members, to see if they can maybe share housing costs. You know, some members of Congress sleep on their couches.
You know, I've heard that. That's true, huh?
It is true. It's a lot cheaper than renting a 400-foot studio for $1,900 a month.
It makes you wonder if some kind of across-the-aisle diplomacy might happen, you know, sitting there sharing your little studio with somebody irrespective of party affiliation.
Well, I think that kind of happened a little bit more in the old days. In fact, years ago, Senator Ted Stevens told me a great story. He was the long-serving Republican from Alaska and told me how years ago he and Hubert Humphrey, the Democrat, would drive to the Capitol together from their homes in suburban Maryland. They'd leave their wives behind with a car because the wives had the kids, and they'd carpool in across party lines. Sadly, that doesn't happen so much in Washington anymore. And while the freshman orientation that these newbies are experiencing now is bipartisan for learning about things like how to manage your office and how to hire staff and what are the ethics rules, there are also a lot of events that occur just within the parties. And the parties do kind of stick to themselves.
What do you say the biggest shocks that these rookie lawmakers are going to go through?
Frankly, I think one of the biggest shocks for a lot of them is just going to be how difficult it is to get anything done in Washington. And that's kind of a sad part of this freshman orientation. A lot of newbies come here and they really have high hopes. They think, you know, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to be the one that works across party lines. Everybody comes fresh off a tough election campaign. They're excited. It's new. It's something different. And they want to do their best. And then they learn pretty quickly that Washington is kind of a tough place and kind of a nasty place and a place where partisanship reigns. So I think that's kind of one of the downsides. But along the more personal lines, a big shock, I think, is the office space. Mm-hmm. Office space is at a premium on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers go through a lottery to pick their offices. One of them told me he thought maybe the worst office space could be in the basement of the House Longworth building. That's one of the office buildings in the Capitol complex. And then he discovered that there was actually even a worse place than the Longworth basement, and that is the fifth floor of the Cannon House office building. That fifth floor was carved out of an attic, and only a few elevators actually go to the fifth floor. It's actually really hard to get there. So I think that might be a shock, too, especially if some of them have had spacious offices at home.
You know, it's interesting, as you describe this, the kind of bump back to reality once they're sworn in and they start working, that perhaps that shiny, happy picture we just saw, the class picture of all the freshmen, could be their happiest moment.
Well, it might be. It could be all downhill from here. I don't know. For some of them, though, it is really awe-inspiring, and I think we kind of have to remember that this is a place, Washington is a place, where we see American democracy in action. And for all of its warts and all of the problems and all the nasty partisanship, these new members are still walking into the United States Capitol, in my view, the most beautiful building in Washington with its soaring rotunda, the wonderful statues, the incredible history. This is a place where, you know, great men and women of our nation have passed through, great speeches have been delivered. So there is, in these early days, also something very awe-inspiring. And, you know, one of your Michigan lawmakers, Representative Candace Miller, runs the House Committee on Administration, and that's the committee that runs the freshman orientation. And she was telling me that she intended to say to these freshmen that there was something really beautiful about our democracy, that the Founding Fathers recognized that lawmakers could leave and their replacement would come in and it would all happen peacefully, and that there's something really to treasure about that. So this is also kind of a moment for remembering that and kind of cherishing that history that we have.
Cheryl, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg's story in the New York Times is After Victory Laps, Settling In as Rookies. There are five new freshmen from Michigan in this congressional class: Brenda Lawrence, Dave Trott, Debbie Dingell, Mike Bishop, and John Molinar. And, of course, Congressman Kerry Peters becomes Senator Peters. Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry is here now. Hi, Jack.
Good to be here.
And we're joined by Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler, who actually joins us from the Hill. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
Well, let's get this right out of the way. Jack, we're losing more than 130 years of experience on Capitol Hill as we bid farewell to Senator Carl Levin and Congressman John Dingell, Dave Camp, Mike Rogers, and then one-term Congressman Kerry Bentivoglio. But looking through history, Jack, have we ever lost so much experience in one fell swoop?
Not since we separated from Great Britain and lost 1,000 years of the British Constitution. No, it's 141 years by my count, and I can't believe there's ever been a time when we lost that much at once.
What does that mean for us in practical terms?
Well, it means less seniority, for one thing, and less expertise. And none of these folks, Todd may be able to clarify this, but none of them seemed especially driven by getting sort of pork barrel spending projects for Michigan, so it probably won't have the dramatic effect that it did in South Carolina, say, when they lost Strom Thurmond, but there certainly will be some downside.
Well, yeah, I don't think that Michigan's ever been, or the Michigan delegation has ever been, quite so determined about earmark, you know, projects like some other states have, particularly big, you know, states like Alaska or out west states. But that being said, when it comes to important stuff like the auto industry and Great Lakes protection, you know, Michigan's delegation has been, you know, pretty instrumental in getting money for things like that, and a lot of that's going to go away.
Todd, if you can break down for us the new Michigan members of Congress, these new faces, and give us a sense of what you think we're getting on the Hill with each of them. We'll start with Dave Trott.
Well, I think in Congressman-elect Trott, I think what you're going to get is somebody who's, you know, marked at least by the local Republican Party in Michigan as someone who's really going to move ahead. I think there are people out there who are thinking that down the road he could be primed for higher office. You know, he's young, he's energetic. He's got a lot of money. He's got a lot of contacts in the Republican Party, especially in Oakland County. And I think he probably could end up being someone who could be a mover and shaker down here in Washington, largely because I think there are people back in Michigan who want him to take on that role. You know, if you move outside of Mr. Trott, you know, I think you're looking at people like John Molinar in Midland, you know, obviously, you know, Debbie Dingell and Mrs. Dingell, who knows this place already better than most. You know, you're looking at Brenda Lawrence from Southfield, the Southfield mayor. You know, it sort of remains to be seen what she's going to be able to bring to the table. It's really a mixed bag in terms of who's coming in.
And what are your thoughts, Jack, on the strengths and weaknesses of each of these folks?
Well, I disagree a slight bit with Todd. David Trott is some of those things, but he's also, I think, 53 or so, which is not that young. And Michigan now will not have an open Senate seat for the foreseeable future. So while he may be a mover and shaker in the House, if he lasts, it's sort of difficult for me to see him going elsewhere. Of this new delegation, it's more female. There are two new women, Brenda Lawrence and Debbie Dingell, as Todd said. It's, however, old for a freshman class, and it's more conservative than the, or more right-wing than the former Congress was, I think. We've got Mike Bishop in Lansing. He's probably the youngest of the new congressmen. I think he's 47. But Debbie Dingell and Brenda Lawrence are both 60. And while Debbie Dingell indeed has sort of been a fixture at the side of her husband for 30-some years, Brenda Lawrence is new. And it's difficult to see how she in particular can accumulate a lot of seniority and a lot of clout in the time she has in Congress.
Jack, do you think bearing that legendary name Dingell will help or hinder the new congresswoman?
Oh, I think it helps. I mean, again, she's not going to have John Dingell's seniority, and people may feel differently about Debbie Dingell than they do John Dingell, but she certainly has a leg up in terms of expertise, certainly because, you know, she shared everything with her husband. They had a very, very close political and personal marriage. So, oh, I think it's a help, and if she lasts 18 years, not impossible, the Dingell seat will have been, that congressional seat, I should say, will have been the Dingell family for a century.
Wow. Hey, how will these five freshmen play with the other members of Michigan's congressional delegation, do you think, Todd?
Well, I think in large measure they're going to play fine. I think there's already been a lot of meetings or talks between these members, the other members of the delegation. And as is usually the case with the Michigan delegation, they're going to come together on Michigan-centric things. It's very seldom that the delegation fights amongst itself on the auto industry or on the Great Lakes or on Asian carp, for instance. They usually, regardless of party, come together, and I see that going forward from now. I will jump back in on the question about Mrs. Dingell, however, because there is still that question about how she will fit in terms of this Democratic caucus, which is still, you know, run by Nancy Pelosi. And I think everybody knows that, you know, Mrs. Pelosi and Mr. Dingell have had their disagreements over the years. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Now, what about what's happening nationally as we see a shift to even more Republicans in the House? Do you think Trott, Bishop, and Molinar will be playing with other congressional Republicans or, you know, to the Tea Party side of things or more the GOP establishment, Jack?
Well, of course, everybody is different. Molinar is probably sort of more on the right fringe, probably as less of a sort of a national profile, national connections than the others. Again, all politics is local. It's important to note maybe that the Democrats are going to have fewer members of the House of Representatives than at any time since 1930. So they're very much in a minority. I think, back to the previous question, I think that it will probably behoove Pelosi and Dingell to get along, since Pelosi is, you know, has some critics in her own party and they don't have that much margin for error. Again, sometimes these folks surprise you, but I think all of the new Congress people will be much more team players, at least on paper, than, say, Kerry Benevolio was, Tim Walberg from the 7th District, sort of Lenawee County, southwestern Michigan, was kind of an outlier in some of the auto industry stuff. I think all these folks will be conventional mainstream Republicans and Democrats.
Do either of you expect any of these freshmen to grab the national spotlight early on? I mean, we've got 435 representatives, but there are very few we know nationally. We've got Paul Ryan, John Dingell, of course. Do you think any of these are likely to get star attention early on, Jack?
I think there'll be stories about Debbie Dingell succeeding her husband and who's the new Dingell and all of that. The others, I would doubt it, but maybe Todd has some thoughts.
Well, I mean, I agree. I mean, my thoughts are that, you know, Mrs. Dingell, without question, is going to be the sort of star of this delegation because of, you know, because of her last name for the first few weeks and months of this new Congress. That being said, you know, in the Michigan delegation, I don't see any of these other new members necessarily grabbing a national spotlight. And I frankly see Mrs. Dingell trying to play that down to a certain degree because I think she wants to make her own way and not rely on her husband's reputation. That being said, you know, I think that Congressman Amash, although he's not a freshman, is somebody that you're going to continue to hear a lot out of the Michigan delegation as somebody who very much charts his own course, very much in terms of that libertarian streak that you don't see from a lot of the other Michigan Republicans. In terms of the delegation at large, I would be looking at him. The other thing I would say is don't be surprised if Congressman Peters, soon to be, you know, Senator Peters, doesn't reach out and try to start making a name for himself. When he went to Congress, he very much stepped out to try to put himself in a position where he was on important committees, where he was on a conference committee that helped write the Dodd-Frank laws. You know, he's somebody who is ambitious, who is going to try to put himself in a position where he can be a player. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see him try to do that, even in a Democratic minority.
Any final thoughts on Congressman Peters morphing into Senator Peters, Jack?
Well, I think that Todd's probably right, although in the Senate there's a little bit more decorum. Freshman senators for their first year or so are supposed to be a little demure about it, so I think he's a cautious guy. He's not going to do any Ted Cruz grandstanding here. But it's also just one final thought I had about Debbie Dingell. It'll be interesting to see. You know, she's going to have her husband's name, but she's not going to have the seniority. She's not going to have the clout on committees, and it'll be interesting to see if she's sort of ready for that kind of natural demotion in status.
Right. She's already getting ready for an office assignment that is nothing like the one Mr. Dingell has. I mean, I think she drew close to the bottom of the heap in terms of, office assignments. And we'll have to see where these folks end up on committees, which is going to play a large part in terms of, you know, where they are in the first Congress or two that they serve in. It's going to be interesting.
That is Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler, joined by Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry. Thank you so much to both of you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Henry Ford gave the world the Model T. Henry Ford Hospital is giving the world the Model G, a new hospital gown that means, get ready, no more bare butts. Michael Forbes designed these. He's product designer at the Henry Ford Innovation Institute in downtown Detroit. Michael, clearly the traditional hospital gown, the hiney-bearing style, if you will, is meant to give doctors and nurses and techs full access. How does your gown still do that and preserve patient modesty?
So in the back of our hospital gown, you'll notice that it's entirely stitched along the back, except for a section from about the small of your back to the base of your neck. And there's a panel there that where the material meets, it actually overlaps for about an inch and a half, and it just falls on top of itself. But when you need clinical access, you can actually reach within there to check for breathing and lung sounds, et cetera.
And it looks great, and it covers everything up. And I have to say the big question I think on many people's minds is, why did it take so long to come up with a no-bare backside gown?
You know, I think it is because it's about hospitals adopting and healthcare adopting new technology and understanding that there's a lot that needs to change. And I think Henry Ford Health System really gets that and understands it.
And the Model G can be getting itself into hospitals beyond the Henry Ford healthcare system, can it, because it's been licensed and ready to go?
Well, we've entered a supply agreement with Carhartt right now, and that's going to be launching in the beginning of 2015. And concurrently, right now, we're still negotiating terms with licensees.
I think patient demand is going to be stepping up, and people are going to really, really want this. So I think on behalf of hospital patients everywhere whose modesty will forthwith be preserved thanks to your efforts, thank you very much.
Oh, it's an honor.
Michael Forbes is a product designer at the Henry Ford Innovation Institute in downtown Detroit. Stateside's director today was Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.